so I am here with Daniel Clowes, who is most recently the author of Mr. Wonderful. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
I wanted to first of all start with the moments of simultaneous consciousness that appear in this work. I think it's safe to say that Mr. Wonderful contains perhaps the most simultaneous consciousness, I think, in all of your work. Although it has been there all along with thoughts and narration often competing with words and dialogue, and even the partial balloons drifting to the panel's edge. So I'm curious, because there are often some panels in this that threaten to subsume the characters themselves, whether there was an effort, a bona fide interest in exploring the possibilities of consciousness or neurosis and narrative, or was this a creative method of beating a weekly deadline imposed by the New York Times?
Well, certainly a bit of the latter, but I've always been intrigued by that aspect of comics, where where you can like a novel, get inside a character's head, and then like a painting or a movie, see the character externally and experience it externally. And I feel like it's sort of unique among narrative art forms in that it can do both of those things well and simultaneously. And I was always intrigued as a kid by the thought balloon, you know, the device of a character thinking. And most old comics, in Superman comics, for example, it was only used when there was a narrative urgency for it. So there would be, just out of, 50 panels, there would be one where Superman's thinking, I've got to get out of here before Lois suspects I'm Clark. And as a kid, it troubled me because I thought, these characters are all thinking in every panel, and why can't, we're not privy to their thoughts.
Yeah.
And so with this work especially, I was trying to make it more about the character's thought and his inner world in conflict with the outer world, but you're seeing it filtered through his vision of the world, and as we all do, our own thoughts tend to obliterate what's actually happening around us, even what we're doing and saying.
Yeah. Well, this also makes me want to ask you about the different lettering that you've used for the narration. There's the sort of formal narration, or the formal lettering that you have in some of the narration in Wilson, but that's been there also in the early issues of 8-Ball. I'm wondering if words were more of, I suppose, the focal point for these characters this time around, or what motivates words in your life? Is it sometimes the way they look more than the way they sound, or?
No, not, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I like the way that hand lettering looks. I don't think when I read dialogue that's done in a font or done on a computer, even if it's an artist's hand lettering that's turned into a computer font, it somehow reads, I read it with a robotic voice. There's something about the organic quality of actual, hand-inked lettering that evokes something human to me. But is this whistle gonna drive you crazy? It's okay. All right. But I'm more interested in the words, the way they sound, kind of musically interlinked with the rhythm of how you read the panels. So it's, I have a certain way of reading each story in mind that I'm hoping to transfer to the reader.
I also wanted to ask you about the sound effects in Mr. Wonderful. You tend to be sparing about these. However,
usually.
I did notice that there was a flip-flip when Marshall reads the newspaper. There was a chof-chof when he eats the fries. I'm wondering, when Mr. Wonderful originally appeared in the New York Times, whether the newspaper format encouraged you to ride the sound motif this time. I have a sort of follow-up question in relation to the fries, but I'm curious to get the answers here.
The one I liked was smooth when he's fixing his hair.
Yeah, but,
I did that. I added sound effects a little more than I might normally have, just because it was in the New York Times and I found it funny to put sound effects and stupid things like that in the New York Times.
And a newspaper doesn't typically carry.
And I was sort of trying to carry the tropes of comics into this kind of mainstream world and make them, make them, to normalize them for the mass readers that I imagined were going to read this strip and who did not in fact show up.
But I also understand that you received absolutely no mail whatsoever in response to the New York Times running Mr. Wonderful, that people were either ignorant or mystified or just didn't notice it or something along these lines. I had read something with you.
I mean, the paper received mail from angry Southerners who objected to the use of the word Jesus.
about it, but nothing directed towards you personally?
No, death threats, unfortunately. But no, it was, you know, the very first episode and maybe the second episode, I would get the kind of response that I would normally get for one of my books, you know, from all the people in my life. And by the third or fourth episode, I could tell that people had forgotten to read one and they were feeling lost. And towards the end, there were a tiny core of my most devoted readers who were obsessively reading it, but everybody else was waiting for the book by then, you know. And it was just the weekly experience of trying to follow something like that is not something that this world is conducive to anymore, you know. It just doesn't work.
On the other hand, they had no problem following the rather surreal Velvet Glove as well. I mean, so
that
you should be used to this.
That was
by
a
now.
Different world. That was an entirely different world. You know, when I was doing that, that was a world where, you know, I've just been going through my archives, which consists of like a closet with everything stacked on the floor, and I found a box of all the old letters I used to get when I was doing 8-Ball back in the 90s. And I didn't remember this, but I used to get very often, like once a week, I'd get at least a 25-page letter from a total stranger. And people just didn't have any way to let this out, and they saw me as sort of, you know, somebody that they could safely talk to that they would never meet, and I would never judge them.
This is in the pre-Cambrian, pre-internet age, too.
Age, and so it was a way of, you know, sort of releasing all this pent-up, you know, information and things they wanted to share. And ever since, you know, the internet has taken hold, you know, I just recently started my own website, and we have a little mail section on there. And I thought, you know, I thought I'd get something similar, long letters from people. And all I ever get are people saying, like, check out my blog, and, you know, like a URL, and like, not even like, dear sir, to this kind of quick thing. So it's a very different audience that read that Velvet Glove story than the one that exists now.
Do you need to have some kind of feedback from the audience? And it almost seems to me that you have now have the advantage of insulation if nobody's responding directly to you with 25-page letters.
Not, you know, at that time, I really did need it because I had no idea if anything I was doing made any sense. You know, I often felt like I was crazy, especially doing that Velvet Glove story. It was very personal and based on my own kind of inner life and dreams and things. And it was good to hear back from people that at least a few people were responding to it, and it meant something to others. But now I have a much better sense of what I'm doing and how people are going to respond to it. I usually have some idea going in what the general attitude about something will be, so I don't need that as much.
For feedback, you rely upon friends and peers now, or
none at all. You know, I mean, I get this sort of general distant feedback. You know, I find it's like the book is selling well. You know, you hear things like that, and that's all I really need. You know, I need to just hear some general sense of like it's out there. People are responding the way they always do, and it's in the world, and that's all I need to know.
Got it. Ice Haven featured some Chris Ware homages of tiny paddles loaded with minuscule detail then and so forth. But often there's a lot of detail compressed within that one frame. And Mr. Wonderful features a number of moments in which something that was originally running in the New York Times is now across a two-page. It's like one panel across two page.
Right.
This makes me want to ask you about how the final size of a panel affects the amount of detail that you compress or that you expand in this. What's the notion of size of details in relation to panels? I'm curious.
Well, with this, you know, my natural inclination is to fill up every square inch with as much detail as I can, because I always feel like I'm cheating the reader if I don't do that. I have, you know, this some kind of Protestant ethic where I want to, you know, give them value for their money. And so I can't stand to have a blank page in any of my books unless it has meaning as a blank page. And so with Mr. Wonderful, I felt I needed something to bridge the strips as they appeared. You know, they were cliffhangers. You know, I was trying to get people to sort of be waiting around by the water cooler, you know, talking about it every week. What's going to happen next to Marshall? You know, and I didn't have that element of time when I put the book together, and so I was trying to find a way to use the extra space I had to kind of freeze the moment so that he, you know, you wouldn't just feel like you were abruptly going from cliffhanger to resolution. And so I came up with the idea of doing these kind of gigantic CinemaScope blown up panels that seemed to sort of freeze time in that specific moment when juxtaposed with all these little panels. And so
it's also a security mechanism, so you don't clutter it with more of his consciousness as well.
Right. Yeah. And I couldn't step on, you know, what I had already put in there. So it had to be something that was external to the story. And so it took a lot of willpower to not make those more detailed than they needed to be. And I wound up paring them down as much as I could. And I was proud of myself the way they turned out. You know, when I look through the book, I am always shocked to see how simple some of the drawings are.
Willpower, such as drawing additional moles on Marshall, or what?
Freckles and moles, you know, maybe I'll put the background in there, and then, you know, then I'm off to the races, and I'm doing 5 overlays with shading on the windows and the background and things.
Were there original versions of the panels that were more detailed that you had to stop or you had to start again or anything?
Yes. Almost every case. Yeah.
I
mean, there's one 2-page spread where it's just the sound effect of a car, you know, and I felt so cheap doing that. I thought, like, oh, that's just, you know, that's just so minimal. And I tried all these other things that just involved getting the same effect but doing more work. And, of course, every one of them diminished from the effect I was going to for, until finally I just had to accept that was the best way to do it.
Yes. As a fellow gentleman who also has the male pattern baldness, I feel compelled to ask you about bald spots. In Wilson, his physical form changes from set to set to set. He's often chunkier, he's often muscular, he is receding in different places each time. And I noticed that in Mr. Wonderful, when you expand to one of these large panels, we do in fact see the sliver of a bald spot.
He has a bald spot throughout, I think.
Yeah. But we don't really see it so much in some of the smaller panels.
No, it looks weird if you have this little dot of flesh, you know, in a small panel.
Yeah. To wrestle the idea of bald spots in comics, is it really just a matter of liking to draw these? Or?
I'm trying to support our community.
Oh, yes, exactly. You meet in the secret halls as well as
I
do. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
No,
they don't know how much we are.
Again, I'm trying to normalize our ilk for the rest of the world.
Yeah. What about the 6-panel approach of Wilson? I mean, sometimes we see...
There's 7 and 8.
Sometimes we see at the very bottom of the row, we see like 3 there. But I'm curious if that formalism caused you to shift Wilson's appearance. I was always curious about why he was. Was it just a matter of just trying to almost have any kind of reader reading this would find her version of Wilson in the actual...
That was sort of the... Yeah. I mean, that was part of the intent, and then that we all see ourselves very differently from day to day. And I thought I was trying to capture all the various ways Wilson sees himself and feels about himself, and each one of those looks gives something specific to each of the strips, and I wanted each of them to have their own identity. You know, they exist in this, as you say, very kind of severe structure where it's 6, 7, and 8 panel gag strips, and so I wanted them to have that, but also to have this way they're drastically differentiated from each other.
Sure. I had mentioned Marshall eating a French fry earlier, and I did tell you that I had a follow-up question. I have a rather elaborate one.
Bring it on.
Yeah. I have, and this might just be an expression of my own obsessions, but I have been very interested in the notion of depicting eating in visual mediums. you see a film sometimes, and often they'll go to a restaurant or a diner or a bar or a cafe, and nobody will eat. Similarly, I have noticed in your work that there is a reticence, at least especially in the early work, although we're increasingly seeing more of a development in terms of depicting characters eating.
Mm-hmm.
Although I should point out that in the film of Ghost World, there's a great moment where Bob Balaban is eating that that toast.
There's lots of eating.
Yeah, there's lots of eating. Unlike
Zoigoff enjoys eating.
And yes.
Often, if he can't think of anything else, he would just tell an actor to put a bagel in your mouth and do the line that way.
But in Ghost World, the comic, we don't actually see Enid and Rebecca eating. We see Josh eating.
Yeah.
But eating,
they're too busy talking, I think.
They are too busy talking. People talk and eat. They talk and eat in Ghost World.
It looks weird, though. You don't want to, it makes somebody look, look sort of vulgar if they're talking and eating.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful with things like that. They're very subtle little things in comics. You know, you have just this one panel to express something, and it confuses the audience if you're not, you know.
Well, have you tried to get more eating? Like, for example, the hospital in Mr.
Right.
Wonderful, where incidentally Marshall feels more comfortable there than the diner. Suddenly Klaus feels more comfortable depicting picking at food, actual eating, and I was reading this championing the character's eating, and so
I think that's he's relaxed, before he's sort of taking a little bite, and he's not even thinking about eating. You know, if you show somebody eating it, they seem at ease.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to show, he's given up, he's totally relaxed, and he's free to just eat his French fries.
Well, have you agonized over depicting eating moments over the years at all, or?
It's all intuitive, you don't think about it. You don't think about the details of it. You're thinking about how to get across the sort of the performance of the character and how best to do that. Drawing table settings is really difficult. It's like one of the more difficult things you can do, because you have to draw plates and perspective, and you have to kind of keep everything in the right place. I think, people don't consciously notice if a glass moves from one side of the table to the other, but they unconsciously know something's off. And so it's not at all easy. So I try not to write around that. I try to do my work and get it in there.
So being a script supervisor for your own work, it would seem, would be part of the perfectionist in you.
Table settings are famously the script supervisor's nightmare.
Is there anything more difficult for you for the comics than table settings in terms of getting things?
Oh, yeah. Consistent? There are many things that I have written around that I can't imagine drawing like a detailed battle scene. You know, it's like I might, if I had to do it, I would, but it's not my idea of fun. You know, it would be a chore. Or to draw people riding horses is the one I've tried a few times, and my horses look very weird. I'd have to spend like 3 weeks just working on the horses and get some way to do that down before I could do a Western, I think.
Yeah. In the Ghost World Special Edition, there is a reference photo that you provide indicating that this is the model for the Ghost World hardcover photo. This leads me to ask, since we were talking about panel size before, how much reference you actually need. I mean, in the case of horses, I'm wondering if part of the difficulty has been getting enough horses to model for you or to be photographed.
There's certainly plenty of reference nowadays on the internet, and as it's gotten more and more available, I've tried to use less and less of it, because I find it, I can look back on my work and say like, oh, I just looked at a photograph of a payphone there, and there's something much stronger about trying to remember what a payphone looks like, and that way you capture both the essence of a payphone, and you also capture what your vision of a payphone is. And so I try to only use reference if it's something that I just can't get a clear picture in my head. I mean, that reference photo of my wife for the back cover of Ghost World, that was for doing a very specific kind of detailed painting. I wanted it to look like sort of like an old pinup painting. And so I wanted it to have kind of that phony posed look. And so that, I would use a photo for something like that, but I almost never for a person ever use a photo.
At what point do you just simply draw a gesture without reference? I mean, it's said that some people say that, you can tell when a cartoonist is coming into a room, you immediately know who he is, because that's exactly like the drawings. Is there a similar predicament in terms of just wanting to be off of the reference altogether and using your imagination to get something that's a little bit unreal? What do you do in a situation like that?
I try to always go in that direction. You know, I'm much more interested in making things up, and it you know, it's not it doesn't always work out, and then you have to go back and fix it. But very often, it's much truer than if you're fussing over it too much and trying to get things perfect.
But when you're talking about capturing the essence of a payphone, yeah, if you fuss over it too much, is it going to have an impact on capturing the essence?
No, if you fuss over it too much, it pulls it out of the rest of the world, which is not fussed over. I try to draw as naturally as I can, and which took me forever. You know, my early work is I look at it and it makes my hand ache from thinking how agitated I was trying to get everything a certain way and not getting there, and it was just constantly frustrating, and I was always throwing pages out the window and starting over and whiting out entire faces and pasting things on, and it was never pleasurable. And in the last 5 or 6 years, I've gotten to the point where I can draw a page that I feel good about without absolute agony, or at least I know how to fix it at this point. I know that it's everything is fixable.
Is fixing, though, doesn't it come from pre-thinking what the panel is going to look like at some point? I mean, if you think about it, if you deliberate about it, will you make less mistakes or fewer mistakes? Or
it doesn't really seem to have any effect on the mistakes, whether you're how prepared you are. The mistakes come from being just sort of being in a physically strange mode at that moment, and I can't quite describe it, but there's certain days where I know the drawings aren't going to come out right.
Physically strange mode. Can you even make an attempt?
Just where you're you just feel out of sync with your hand. I mean, drawing comics is it's not an aerobic exercise, but it's a very physical thing, the way it's done with pen and ink and paper, and you're really, I find myself like sitting up on the edge of my seat, and there's sometimes you're just disconnected from your body, and you imagine, when a baseball player's going through a three-game slump without a hit, it must feel that way, where you're just not connecting with it. And then there are certain days where you sit down and it couldn't be more effortless, and every panel comes out perfect, and you can, in 15 minutes, you can draw a complicated page that looks beautiful. Just all of a sudden but you can't count on that. You have to do the work every day.
Now, do you do any calisthenics? I know you go for a walk every day. What do you do to just stay physically in shape in order to actually make sure that you don't have this physical incongruity?
I try to stay in shape. I didn't so much when I was younger. I didn't need to as much, but now that I've hit 50, I try to go for long walks, and I play tennis and stuff with my son, and do stretches and stuff, so I don't become like a calcified old man with osteoporosis.
Yeah, but calcified old men could perhaps launch a legion of cynics and misanthropes into the actual art itself, in terms of creating those characters.
You could.
Maybe there's some advantage to having ill health at times.
I don't know. You don't want to have back problems.
Yeah.
Which I've never had, fortunately, but that's things like that have sidelined many a cartoonist.
Yeah. The second act of David Boring, which takes place on Hooligan's Wharf, it includes this table scene where you...
Don't expect me to remember anything about my work, by the way.
Well, I think you'll remember this, because
okay,
it has this table scene where you introduce a number of characters and you write the narration. If you get confused, you may want to refer back to the scene.
Right.
The thing that's interesting about that is the great conceit of that is that suddenly a good chunk of these characters are killed off. I'm curious because was this a concession to the reader's ability to follow the events, or was it simply a complicated storyline that you were trying to maintain? This is the best way to kind of simplify things into points of resolution, because this had come after, of course, Ghost World and Velvet Glove. Or was killing off characters just, maybe you saw something you wanted to draw and like, hey, that steers the story, that steers the narrative? I was always really curious about this.
Well, I like the idea that I thought people would actually remember that, and then as they're going through the story, they would come back to that point, and so that made that point sort of a locus for the rest of the story, where they'd keep returning to that point and maybe reread from that point on over and over. And I like the idea of this kind of loop that you're stuck on, where as each character dies, you come back and wait, who was this again? You know, and
it's your own mini Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, right. And you kind of understood the relationships of the characters, but then you didn't really remember who they were in relation to each other, to the characters they're not interacting with. And so I thought it was, I don't know, I actually just found it funny to do that.
Well, did you ever get bogged down in so many story details? You're combating this imagination in that and in Velvet Glove. And the sense I got when reading those was, I'm not sure if he even knows what's going on. Or is it safe to say?
In both cases, which is, it's somewhat terrifying to admit, because both of them were, they were very much, you know, lived in at the time, and they seemed lucid and clear to me, and then I reread the Velvet Glove story a few years ago, and I remembered what I was doing, and I knew why it played out the way it did. But I thought there's absolutely no way anybody else could grasp, you know, anything but a fraction of what's going on here, unless they were so tuned into the thing. You know, there have been a few people who've really devoted a lot of time to it and have picked up a lot of little nuances that I'm shocked they found, but it's really sort of the work of a schizophrenic, you know, one of those guys who, like a Henry Darger type, you know, creating his own little world.
Now, does this explain the impetus to move into a more, I suppose, subtle or layered narrative like David Boring or even like Wilson, which is really fixed in its own way towards these 6 to 8 panels?
Yeah. Wilson certainly came from a different impetus. I mean, with Wilson, I wanted it to be as simple as I could make a comic, you know, just something that a normal person could pick up and read one of the strips and get something out of the joke, perhaps. But that when put all together and when read in one sitting in this, you know, thick hardcover, that it would have some kind of resonance that was the accumulation of all these strips, and that it had something more than its simplicity.
Mm-hmm. Something more than its simplicity.
Yeah.
So there always needs to be something more, I suppose, for any work you take on here.
Yeah, you got to keep yourself occupied. You know, you gotta keep your brain engaged.
To follow up on one point in relation to David Boring, do you often change the story direction if you find something interesting that you want to draw? I didn't quite. Have you done that before?
Almost always.
Yeah. Does this explain the jarring moments in between the three acts of David Boring?
Well, the moment in between the first two acts.
Yeah.
That was sort of where I began with the whole story. I realized that I was doing these issues of 8-Ball, my comic book, and they were coming out farther and farther apart, and I was doing these continued stories, and people were forgetting what was happening, or just even forgetting that I existed, and then they'd have to all of a sudden pick back up in this story that they had long forgotten about. And so I thought, I'm not going to get any faster, so I need to make that amusing to myself. So I loved the idea that I would end a chapter with a bullet flying towards someone's head, and that the bullet would then land a year later.
Yeah.
I just thought that was such a cruel thing to do to my readers.
Well, the other thing too is that, and it's appeared frequently in your work, is you have this tendency to have a character shoot at the audience, which reminds me very much of the Great Train Robbery.
Right.
I'm wondering how much these film references tend to also determine the direction of the narrative at times.
I hope not at all. You know, those things are usually, you know, just things that are lodged somewhere in the back of my unconscious. But there's something about shooting at the reader in a comic that you can freeze that moment in a way better than you could. I've never seen it in a film where a bullet comes at you somehow. It doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's always sort of glancing off to the side.
Well, you have bad CGI. I like that.
I guess so, yeah.
The many older men, younger women relationships, and here in Mr. Wonderful, we have that again. With the exception of David Boring, the second act on the island with the mom, this has been a very frequent relationship formation. I'm curious.
I didn't think of Natalie and Mr. Wonderful as being... I thought of her as being like 3 or 4 years younger.
Okay. Well, but what of the recurrence of this in your work? I've noticed this quite a bit.
Well, my wife is younger than I am, and so I think that's sort of the one dynamic I have in my life that I'm, that's seeping into everything I do, and so I think there's something about that that just plays itself out over and over.
Yeah. Leopold and Loeb and Icehaven, numerous mystery components. Of course, the actual story, Art School Confidential. How much mystery novels do you read? I was curious. What have you read lately?
I've read Chandler and those guys many years ago, and some of the more obscure guys like David Goodis and Kenneth Fearing and those guys. But really, not for years and years. And I don't think I've ever read a mystery like a whodunit.
Yeah. More true crime stuff?
Yeah, or just I'm more into the atmosphere of it. I'm not really that interested in the crime part of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that part's somewhat interesting, but I just like, those are the guys who are writing about this kind of, the creepy part of town. You know, I'm sort of interested in the kind of like the bad urban neighborhoods of the past.
Yeah. You had mentioned this schizophrenic period, and during that schizophrenic period, you tended
probably
to
bipolar rather than, I don't
whatever,
know
whatever yeah. the bleak period, I suppose.
Yes,
the,
yes.
You tended to reference yourself quite a bit. That has staved off more or less. Have you managed to get your quotient of navel gazing in throughout these latest works, or do you fear or not fear? Do you think that you'll have some deep fake introspective or real introspective moment that you'll be pursuing anytime in the future?
I don't know. You know, when I did those stories, those were no more about me than the current stories are.
Yeah.
There was something emboldening about doing that, of just not worrying about that kind of... I'm a very self-conscious person in person, and so to sort of free myself up on paper and to be able to do that was important at that time, but it's not something I feel any urgency to do anymore.
What about OK Soda? I was always curious about this. You said that you were contacted by a Portland advertising agency and that you weren't aware that this effort to reach the Generation X demographic came from Coca-Cola. I'm wondering if you had any ethical qualms about this idea of almost just completely selling out your voice or... transforming it to a kind of marketing or advertising approach. I mean, you've taken on other advertising work as well. It seems to me that you're perfectly comfortable with the OK Soda thing, even though it was this, it seems to me it's kind of a cynical attempt to reach reach an audience directly for cynicism, almost anticipating what is now done with things like Comic-Con, where they managed to essentially target an audience very effectively to do these sort of Mark Millar superhero vigilante epics that are often quite hollow spectacles.
I suppose. The fact that it was Coca-Cola, I had some qualms about it, but I, on some level, deep down, I knew that this was going to be a debacle. You know, I knew that it felt like one of those things that you could sort of not do and step aside and be not a part of, but it felt like something that you wanted to be a part of. I can't explain it in any other way. It just felt like this moment in time, and it sort of felt like it was going to kill this whole area of culture that I wanted dead.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt like that would put this whole, the whole like grunge culture that was surrounding me that I was not happy with, it would just bury it, and it would help to do that. And there was just something about it. It seemed really, it seemed more subversive to do it than not to do it somehow. Because nobody wanted me to do it. Everybody was really appalled.
Yeah, sort of the equivalent of what Chumbawamba did as well.
I don't even know what that is, but...
This wasn't the only advertising work you did. I mean, does your decision to take on advertising work have a lot to do with being able to prefigure the mechanism with which you will operate and with which it's likely to be successful, or...?
No, no. I mean, I haven't done much. I've turned down, you know, many hundreds of thousands of dollars of advertising work over the years. And it's, it, you know, it, as a cartoonist, you have to figure out ways to support yourself. And often it's just a matter of, you know, here's something I can do in an afternoon that will pay for 6 months of rent. You know, and at the time I was doing more of it, that was usually the case. And you'd sort of think, is this something palatable, or is this, you know, am I contributing to the evil in the world? But you have to, if you're going to be involved in that at all, you have to kind of be a mercenary about it to some degree and turn yourself into a, you know, like one of the characters on Mad Men, you know, where you're just a, like, I'm an ad guy now. And I'd always sort of, as a kid, kind of been interested in the whole idea of advertising. And some of the stuff, when I got involved with it, I really wanted to learn, like, what, you know, about mind control and all this kind of, the stuff that I would read about as a kid, subliminal seduction and all that stuff. And you'd find that people who work in ad agencies are just, they're just like boring schmucks like everybody else, and they don't really know what they're doing. It's really it's just, you know, they're just guessing at what might work. They have no idea.
What audience do you now infuriate? Do you infuriate by accident? Has that been pretty much the mode of your career, I suppose?
I'm not that aware of what the audience is anymore. It's a whole different thing. You know, I don't get the 25 page letters, and it's all very remote and distant. And I am sort of comfortable with that. You know, for years I wanted to build this kind of community with the audience. And now I feel like I don't need to do that in a hands-on way. I can put the work out there and just sort of hope that it is responded to in some way. And I don't need to get anything back necessarily.
Well, I ask because I noticed that one of your New Yorker covers, the PhD one, received a responsive article by two PhDs who were upset in the Chronicle of Higher Education. That was
gratifying, I have to say.
Well, they wrote, why did the folks at the New Yorker and the distinguished artist Daniel Clowes decide that creating this image called the Boomerang Generation would be a humorous and relevant depiction of contemporary life? And then she proceeded to overanalyze the cover and conclude, somehow the PhD is being treated as merely a keepsake, like a seashell from a trip to the beach or a poster from a rock concert. In other words, these two academics, the only way that they can actually be offended is by not comprehending the joke. And so,
which you know, makes the point for me, of course.
Of course, of course. But, I mean, is that really the way that your art sort of gets under the skin of people now? Just miscomprehension? Or?
Maybe so. That cover was really, my wife had gotten a PhD a few years before that and felt very much like the poor guy on the cover. And you know, it was a big issue around our house, of course. And when I did that, I never thought of it as anything that anybody would take offense to at all. And reading that article was, I guess it was gratifying to see that somebody, you know, somebody got really worked up over that. The responses to that were so hilarious from grad students, mostly. You know, they're all very smart, you know, so they had these very witty responses. And
is there any such thing as an outsider cartoonist now, or an alternative cartoonist, or an underground cartoonist?
There's no outsider anything anymore, is there? I mean, but still, the kind of stuff that I'm doing, you know, people tend to mislabel it. It's like, well, now he was in the New York Times and he does New Yorker covers and his stuff is mainstream, and it's still very much a small audience. It's not a, you know, there's not a big audience out there for the kind of comics I do, and I am very aware of that and comfortable with that at this point. But when I was younger, I really felt like comics could be a mass medium, and the kinds of things that I was doing, or especially somebody like Peter Bagg was doing, I thought could be enormous, you know, could be as big as The Simpsons, and I now see that is not the case. And so I just don't want people to get the wrong idea that the kinds of things we're doing are like the equivalent of, you know, John Updike novels in the 70s or something. Yeah.
So you're an insider-outsider or an outsider-insider?
I guess. I don't know. It's all too confusing. I mean, I feel, I've always said this, but I feel gratified that nobody ever came up with a good label for my generation of cartoonists. Yeah. So we're not dated, you know, we're not like, oh, the guys from the 90s, you know, the...
Why did you write Art School Confidential, the movie, alone? I mean, you and Zwigoff really did very heavy, close work together. I was always curious about that, too.
I later found out that I should have gotten a solo credit for Ghost World, really, because it's when a director works on a film, they're supposed to contribute something like 70%.
And, yeah.
And I really wrote almost all of it. And then he would give me his ideas, and I'd incorporate them in the way, that's how screenwriters and directors work. But with the second film, we worked almost in exactly the same way, but I just took the credit because that's what my agent told me to do. You know, it was one of those things.
How much are you at the behest of agents and managers these days? Are you just letting them deal with all the legalese?
There are many barnacles attached to my rotting whale-like figure. It's shocking how many lawyers and agents and things like that you wind up with after a while.
But they pretty much take care of everything, and you don't deal with any kind of interference whatsoever these days? Or?
Well, you just can't do, you know, you can't, I don't know how to negotiate a publishing deal. You know, I don't know how to, like, play hardball and, you know, look at a contract and know where I'm being ripped off. So it's like you have to have people doing all that stuff. And it's, I mean, luckily I have nice people working for me, you know, or I'm working for them. I don't remember which.
Well, on that note, Dan Klaus, thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, sir. That was great.